Live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona, you are listening to Breakthrough Thinking. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Isaac, the host. And if it is the second Tuesday of the month from 2 to 3, it is People and Games starring Paul Loudon. Paul, how are you?
Doing all right, Dave.
This is great because all the way from Houston, a lot warmer here, even though it's cold in Phoenix these days.
Yeah, it's probably about 10 degrees warmer here today than it is back in Houston. I'm already seeing the weather back home showing up on my phone to let me know what it's going to be like when I get back.
Oh, wow. So, freezing, I bet.
Pretty close.
Yeah,
right,
I
right
can
on
imagine.
The edge.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And, of course, it was pretty cold. We got down about 37, 36, I think, last night here in Phoenix.
Oh, well.
That sounds cold.
I was asleep. So.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, what was I doing? I think I was asleep dreaming about the cold. So, anyway, so People and Games, a great show. Just, what, about 3 months into the show?
I think 3 or 4 months, depending on whether you count that first entertainment show as our first episode or not.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, we could count that or maybe not. But it's a fascinating show to me about, you know, anywhere from game designing to developers, which I guess is synonymous with game designing, perhaps, or maybe not.
It depends on your perspective and what you think of as a game, and that's sort of what we're going to be talking about.
Yeah.
Because, you know, mostly we're talking about computer games because that's my area of greatest knowledge, but we're also talking about, you know, games as a part of our culture, games as art, games as teaching tools, games as that, and that goes to just, you know, video games and paper games, board games, card games, football, sports, all of those are ways that we use games in life. And so, you know, what I want to talk about today is when we say game, what do we mean by that? How do we know something is a game? Because, you know, when you stop and think about it, last month we talked with the designer of the Stanley Parable. And we talked about how some people may not see that as a game because it doesn't have objectives, there's no winning and losing, that you know, what we talk about as games aren't necessarily what one might traditionally consider a game. But for the most part, people still call them games because they come from that path of development, that path of it started with the old games, Ancient Egypt and Go, and then the sort of tactical board games and sports and stuff. So we started with those games, and we still call things games. And some people are now saying, well, maybe we should have more words for these. Maybe we should come up with ways to talk about, you know, games versus interactive experiences versus the advertising games and you know, what we talk about. And, well, I don't think it's that important what words we use because really, you know, calling something a game versus calling it an interactive experience, it can be a false distinction since we don't have a hard definition of game anyway. But I want to talk about, you know, what they are and why people ask this question of, is this really a game?
So does it sounds like, you know, it's interesting. You said a little bit earlier, games in life. And I suspect it sort of models or could model a game what happens in life without necessarily the consequences on a real basis.
And that's actually really true, especially of our earlier games. A lot of games were designed as ways to teach life strategies of one sort or another. That a lot of games are sports, you know, football or baseball and then older sports, you know, or tag even. Tag is a very hunter-gatherer thing. It's one person trying to hunt down and catch other people, and then if they're on his side, a group of people trying to find the last one or whatever, that depending on your rules or whatever. But the tag sort of is a way to teach someone those skills of hunting and hide-and-seek, especially when you're trying to spot where someone's hiding, when you're trying to sneak up on them, that it was a way of passing on the beginnings, not necessarily, you know, an in-depth knowledge of the skill, but the beginnings and the basics of these skills as a game so that people were engaging in it and practicing it at extremely young ages when if you said, okay, now we need to spend 2 hours practicing hunting, a young child might be like, oh, but Daddy, I don't want to, you know, but if you turn it into a game, it becomes a thing. And so a lot of our oldest games, and even a lot of our modern games teach things like that.
You know, that makes a lot of sense. And often you've mentioned, you know, games as educational pieces where it doesn't feel like an educational piece. It feels like a game, but you're learning so much more because you're highly receptive to the moment in which you participate.
I firmly believe that the best educational game is the one where the person learning doesn't realize they're learning. And that's,
yeah.
that's kind of true for a lot of education. And if you think about, you know, let's go to something like poker. The stakes in poker, whether you're playing for real money or if you're just playing for, you know, chips handed out to have fun, the game is two parts. It's about judging the odds, so understanding and having getting a feeling for probability in general. And it's about judging people, seeing who is lying to and who's telling the truth. If you think about poker, it's sort of a metaphor for shopping and for trading because,
yeah.
you know, you're making the same decisions of what is what I've got worth more than what he's got. He says what he's got is worth, you know, $50. I've so far said mine's worth $40, but maybe it's worth $60. And so it's making a bet on it. It's really a negotiation between a group of people over, you know, who thinks they have the most valuable thing and it's worth, you know, everyone else's money, as it were. So poker, in a weird sort of way, teaches you this bargaining skill, or at least the instincts necessary to then go and transfer them to bargaining. And a lot of games are like that when you look at them, that chess is supposed to be a game of military tactics. And it's a very simplified game of military tactics, but it still teaches you that you have a selection of different units that can move in different ways, they can act in different ways, they have different strengths and weaknesses. It teaches you to think carefully about what resources do I have left and what can I use them for. And while that's a military thought process, that's also just sort of a general life skill, looking at what do I have, what can it do, you know, and looking ahead, saying, okay, you know, next week I can use what I've got for this if I don't waste it in the following week. So a lot of them are sort of general purpose thinking skills. And
and you know what's interesting, you mentioned poker, and I'm not much of a poker player. On the cruise, though, I had last month, I did try my hand at poker, didn't do very well, but that's you mentioned it's negotiation skills in poker, also exchange of values, but also there's a concept called bluffing, and where there may be no value except in your communication of thinking there is value.
Yeah. And that's sort of a part of negotiation, too, is that
yeah.
you want to sell what you've got for the highest price possible. And the highest price possible is what someone else will pay for it, not what it costs me or what it's worth to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, it still goes into that. Bluffing, you know, we talk about lying as generally being a bad thing, but it's sort of a realistic part of life that you aren't always telling the whole truth. And that's a lot what bluffing about. You don't bluff by saying, oh, I've got a full house. You bluff by very carefully making sure people can't tell that you got a pair of fours.
And also in the context, there's boundaries in that game, which bluffing is allowed. It's actually seen as a valuable skill,
mm-hmm.
and that's part of the rule. So it's not about, like if you're on the open market and you have a bad product, but you're making it look like a good product to mess someone up. It's within the game set. The way it's designed, poker has an element of bluffing where you don't have anything, but it's acceptable in that context.
Exactly.
So, you know, that maybe it deviates a little bit from life, except in life, unfortunately, have people without integrity that may want to pass on a bad product. And a good skill is to recognize when you're getting maybe not the best deal.
Yeah, that's very much a skill. It's spotting who's bluffing and looking for tells and things like that. So, yeah, and one common trend about a lot of old games is that typically games are played either one-on-one or, you know, four individuals or team versus team, but all games, not all games, but the vast majority of things we think of as games, especially older ones, are competitive. They're human versus human, with the rules providing a level playing ground and creating whatever instruction the game is going to develop, but they're competitive. And alongside that, you have puzzles, and those might be number puzzles. You know, everyone's playing Sudoku now, and that's a type of number puzzle, or, you know, crossword puzzles, whatever, where we tend to think of puzzles as a separate category from games, and they are person versus a pre-constructed challenge that you have to think your way through it. You have to solve it. It might be as simple as coming up with the answer to a riddle. You know, and it might be, you know, much more challenging, you know, scavenger hunts or other things. But we tend to think of those as puzzles, as a separate category from games. And this has changed sort of over the years, because as we came into video games, which is what I talk about the most right now, video games, in a large part, are very complex puzzles, if you really want to think about it that way, because everything in them is pre-written by someone. Everything in them is programmed. So one way of thinking about it is any game that you're not playing against another person is really an extremely complex puzzle. But in a lot of cases, the role of the other person is taken by a virtual person controlled by the computer, a simplified artificial intelligence. So the goal of a lot of games is to trick you into thinking there are other people there or to give you challenges that are similar to playing against someone. So we've decided, okay, if the puzzle is complicated enough, we still think of it like a game. You know, we don't require this other person to be there, that if you win against the computer, it's a game. And so that was a shift in our thinking when we started having games, when we went from Pong to games against the computer, when Pong got a computer-controlled paddle on the other side rather than a human-controlled paddle, it suddenly became a game because or stayed a game, rather than becoming a puzzle. For example, Pac-Man, that's a game you've heard of before.
Oh, yeah, and I've played.
And you've played.
Not very well.
You think of Pac-Man as a game. And a lot of people think of Pac-Man as a game because you're trying to avoid and outwit the ghosts.
Yeah.
The really interesting thing about Pac-Man is the very best Pac-Man players in the world see it as a puzzle.
Oh.
Because the ghosts always move in the same way. If you follow the right path with the exact same timing, the ghosts will always move in the exact same way. They are 100% predictable. So when you think of them as 100% predictable, suddenly it's a puzzle and not a game. And it's something that you can solve. And people have actually solved Pac-Man. There are people who've played Pac-Man so long that the game runs out. It crashes. They have beaten Pac-Man completely, played all the levels the game has had, and gotten a 100% perfect score, the highest possible score.
And what happens? They just stop?
It crashes. The screen gets, like, gibberish on it. The game gives up.
I didn't know that.
This is in part due to a bug, but it's also because they play it past the point that programmers expected a human being to be able to play it.
Wow.
And so Pac-Man has become a puzzle because we understand how it works. And so there's a solution to it. And then if you think about chess, on the other hand, we know there's a solution to chess out there. We know that there's a perfect move for every board state that has the highest odds of winning moving from that board state. We haven't solved it yet because our computers aren't fast enough. So chess is still an interesting game to watch because not every game is the same. But one day, we'll have computers fast enough and with enough memory that they'll be able to analyze every possible chess move. And once that happens, chess becomes a lot less interesting because everyone knows this is the best move to play if this is the board state. It becomes a game of memorization rather than planning and trying to trick an opponent. So chess is solvable, but we think of it a game right now, but programmers, again, often think of it as a puzzle. So there's this blurred line between puzzles and games. And I think it's sort of what led to, you know, modern video games and how people are just calling everything games, because this distinction, it exists if you want to get really technical and pedantic about things, but it sort of becomes one where it doesn't serve a purpose. It's a distinction that doesn't really gain us anything.
So that's interesting, because I used to play chess a lot in high school, and I was actually on the chess team, believe it or not, and I wasn't bad. I wasn't as good as the Los Angeles city champion, because I played him. And he took me out really quickly. he must have been a computer type of guy. But you're saying, so if you know all the combinations, which there must be ridiculous amounts.
Oh, absolutely.
I can't even imagine. Then there's always a perfect move, and you can never lose.
There's not always a perfect move, but there's always a best move.
Yeah.
That maybe moving this pawn only ends up in 50 million possible situations where you move, whereas moving this pawn ends up in 270 million possible situations where you lose. So which move tilts the odds the most in your favor?
So let me ask you this. If at some point you said the computers will be fast enough, big enough to hold all this memory to know every possible move there is, which seems amazing to me, and if you had two computers doing that at the same time, equal memory, equal quickness, Would it be a draw, or the first move wins?
I don't know, because it could depend on a lot of factors. It could be whoever's the second move wins. It could be the second move has an advantage in chess. It could be the first
move.
Which
we don't know yet.
There's sort of I believe that they are assuming one of the sides has an advantage in chess right now just because of the way humans play chess.
Yeah.
And I don't know which side it is because I'm not a big chess player. But we don't know what it'll turn out to be eventually in with computers.
Right.
For example, you know, there's the game of Go, which is an old Asian board game.
Yeah.
And it's assumed that one side has such an advantage that the other side actually starts off with a set number of points to counterweight that advantage because they've learned that there's an advantage to one side than the other.
Wow.
And so, you know, that's something that, that may go into it. But, it, yeah, it may also always play to a draw. If you think tic-tac-toe is a really simple game, when we know that if two people play tic-tac-toe and they don't know a lot about it, it looks interesting and challenging. But once people know tic-tac-toe well enough, it's always a draw.
Yeah.
Because there are right moves for every situation. And chess is more complex than that. But it will turn out that if you had perfect odds, then the two computers would always play the exact same game every time.
That's what I was thinking. And now checkers, I'm sure the same way. You could figure out every possible
checkers is probably easier to figure out. In fact, I think checkers may have been solved. I'm not sure.
Oh, wow.
I know Connect 4 has been solved.
Now, what is Connect 4? I'm not sure.
It's a board game made by Milton Bradley or Hasbro, one of those. And you've got a grid that stands up, and you drop a red or a black sort of token into it, and you're trying to get a row of four diagonally, horizontally, or vertically. And so you drop one in, then the opponent drops one, and then you drop one in, and then, you know, and so they're trying to sort of cut you off. It's kind of like tic-tac-toe in that you're putting X's and O's and trying to make a thing, except that since you're dropping them down into it, they have to stack up from the bottom to fill in the space. So you can't just put them anywhere. You have to put them in the closest circle to the bottom on each row. So I remember right, it's been solved, and they know that which side will always win, depending on various sizes of the game board, actually.
So let's think about this. As you're mentioning all this, it's interesting. We talked about how games might reflect real-life situation without the consequences or the real consequences. But what will there ever be a game that, and hopefully, wow, what if I'm – you know, saying something I could have rights to and make a ton of money and I'm going to give it out here, but I'm sure someone's thought of this. What if there's a game not the winning, the rewards are not within the game, but if you outline, like chess, you said you can analyze every move eventually if they get computers like that, but you analyze every strategic move someone makes and with incorporating all the variables, and if they duplicate it and the game says, hey, do this in real life, you will achieve X. So if you do Y, you'll achieve X. Is that possible? Do you know what I'm saying?
I'm not entirely sure what you're saying.
So let's say there's a pot of gold. You know, money's not everything in life, for sure. Happiness and other things.
But the pot of gold is a metaphor anyway.
Yeah, pot of gold. And so many people don't have the pot of gold.
Yeah.
I mean, most people don't. You know, they're struggling, right? The paycheck to paycheck. I mean, that's sort of reality for a good portion of the population. That's just sort of how it is, especially in the world. I mean, other than America, America has maybe better opportunities. But the thing is, so you got the pot of gold, and you go, this is exactly the behaviors, how you believe, your values, how you view your identity. These are the moves when you wake up. You know, you sleep X amount of hours, you wake up, and you do boom, 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 and it incorporates variables of economic decline and this, but that will then shift you to other strategies. Guaranteed you get the pot of gold. Is that possible? Do you know what I'm saying?
I don't know how you could guarantee it, though. Here's the thing. The big change in game behavior is whether human nature is allowed. If you have two humans playing chess and they know all the rules and they know all the perfect moves, the game still won't always turn out exactly the same every time because sometimes one of them will make a mistake.
Well, yeah.
So you would have to rule out human nature. Poker. If two computers played poker against each other, it would probably turn out the same every time because they can count cards perfectly, they can predict the odds perfectly, everything about the numbers perfectly. The thing that introduces randomness into poker the most is the bluffing that you mentioned before, that it's humans that really change it. The ability for humans to guess or do something that is not necessarily in their best interest, obviously, but may trick someone else into making a worse mistake.
I got you. So it'd have to be an amazing computer to be able to teach, like in the example of poker, how to become an excellent bluffer.
Yeah.
And then maybe you'd narrow the odds a little bit.
That would narrow the odds a little bit, but you still have to interpret how someone else is going to react to your bluff.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm good at bluffing, but they miss it completely because they're dumb as a stump.
You're right.
And that's how when we solve chess,
yeah,
assuming that we do, there's going to be a period where maybe people will be trying to play it still, and they'll memorize a bunch of best moves, but then someone will intentionally make a bad move because you can't remember all the moves.
Right.
And if they make the right bad move, you're like, oh, shoot, he did something I didn't have something memorized for. What do I do next?
Yeah.
So the challenge is going to be coming up with these strategies of doing a wrong thing in an unpredictable way. And that's how the real world works, is that it's not always about doing the best thing. It's about doing things that cause other people to act the way you want. And it's all about the interaction of humans. And that's where a lot of sports come in, is that, you know, if someone could hit a home run every single time, then baseball would be really boring. If people
right.
played baseball perfectly, it would be the most boring game in the world.
It's already the most boring game in the world.
It's pretty close. Okay, let's take a more interesting game. Football, hockey. If people played all of those perfectly, if one team played
that
absolutely
becomes
perfectly,
more predictable,
it would be
saying.
Really predictable
yeah,
and
yeah.
no one would go. It's the mistakes people make that make games really interesting.
Yeah. Actually, that's a good point, because in real life, sports, it's they always say who makes the team that makes the fewest mistakes, all things being equal, two great teams will probably win.
Yeah.
And they don't say who performs the best. In a way they do, but they go, who makes the fewest turnovers, giveaways, mistakes?
And part of playing a sport isn't just making the fewest mistakes, but creating situations where your opponent can make mistakes.
That's, you know, that's a very good point, too.
You need to make sure those opportunities are presented to your opponent.
That's an excellent point, because that is part of it. Can you create situations to confuse, to break down the other team, to confuse the other team, and thus have them make errors? That's a really good point. I like that. So it's interesting, the game of life and the game of games. You know, the other thing I wrote a couple notes down, some interesting concepts. One, let's do this one, where would you say games, however you define it, stretch people to their full potential? I mean, or can it be designed that way?
It can be designed that way. One thing interesting about the most popular games right now are either sports games, where you play a virtual representation of a real sport. And those are often popular because you can run a team for a whole season. You can do the same thing as fantasy football, where you say, well, what if I got these players together
right.
and play them or whatever? Or the shooter games, the games where, you know, you're just running around and shooting people. And usually those ones are played very competitively against the computer, who is also, or not computer, against another person who's or group of people. It's usually team versus team. And but the interesting thing in designing those games is that realism, like I said, comes from the mistakes. And so to design a game well, you need to have an increase in difficulty over time. To really challenge a person to the fullest, they have to succeed when they first play the game, or they'll be discouraged and not stop. Each time they succeed, there needs to be a challenge that's just within their skill limit waiting for them, that's a little bit harder. So in a sports game, you don't really do that, because not every team is going to be great. You might play a team that's, you know, won their last four games,
right.
and then the next team you play at has lost their last three games. And so it's sort of bumpy. And the trick with realism there is having each team feel like they deserve whatever their rating is when you play them. That when you play a team that's 4-0, you're looking at them going, okay, yeah, they're playing really good. I really need to step up my game.
Yeah.
And then when you play one that's 1-3, you're like, well, you know, and then you go into it and you make mistakes because you've relaxed.
Yeah.
And it feels more realistic.
Yeah.
But the challenge of the game designers is making the computer make the right amount of mistakes, that the 4-0 team has to make less mistakes, the 1-3 team has to make more mistakes, and they have to be the same kind of mistakes a human makes.
Wow.
They can't just have, you know, a star quarterback always throw it, you know, and miss a certain percentage of shots. They've got to miss for believable reasons that you know, that match with real-world experience. And with the shooting-type games, they need to come up with ways to make harder and harder challenges for you as you progress through, because the game needs to always be just within your skill level, but barely. And so they have to figure out what's the average skill level for a person, what's the average skill level for our target audience, how do we make the game progress like that? And again, it's a matter of mistakes, that the computer has to make the right number of mistakes, and you not go, I can just stand here in the middle of the room and they're shooting at the wall, what am I doing here, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's all about mistakes, and that's what changes these from feeling like a puzzle to feeling like a game, because mistakes are an element of randomness, and typically that's how that's how mistakes are handled. There's actually a part of the computer that generates random numbers, and they say, okay, anytime the number is divisible by 10, make this mistake, and then that mistake happens 10% of the time.
Oh,
you know, that,
interesting.
And or, you know, if it's supposed to happen half the time, they do a virtual coin flip. That's how you sort of make it feel less of a puzzle and more of a realistic interaction, is adding this element of randomness tightly defined. You say, you know, they can only make mistakes in these certain situations where a human would make mistakes, and they can only make this type of mistake, but they'll make them this often if they do.
And is that the trend right now? Is that what you're saying? Did the game design start with that in mind back in the day of, what was it, Donkey Kong I played, and, you know, we mentioned Pac-Man, Pong, those type of things? Has game design then developed into, let's add the human element into it?
That has been a strong process in development because, you know, Donkey Kong is very predictable. The barrels bounce in a certain way. Everything, you know, there's some randomness, I think, as to whether he'll throw barrels or fireballs or whatever. I don't know how Donkey Kong works. I haven't put any research into it. But at the same time, once you see something on the screen, it always moves the exact same way. You know exactly how it's going to move. Even when you get to the sort of more advanced games, the NES games, Mario Brothers and stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
You were still playing against, you know, the Goombas, they move back and forth. The Turtles, they move back and forth. Everything moves in predictable ways. They all have patterns that you learn. And so in some ways, that is a puzzle. And so a large element of game design has been taking the puzzleness out of games, except for puzzle games, obviously, games that are meant to be solved, but making a game feel more like it's your skill that does it rather than your thought that does it.
I got you. So, you know, and that's interesting. So that the future games might be really interesting because as people get more sophisticated, maybe the word is, as a programmer, as a game designer, to be able to put the human element in, mistakes in at the right time and the right type of mistakes, then I guess the game becomes way a lot more not like a puzzle, but maybe more entertaining.
Well, that's and this is one really interesting thing that Microsoft is doing right now with their, well, not Microsoft directly, but a studio that's publishing a game for Microsoft. The game is called Forza 5. It's a racing game.
Forza 5?
Yes. F-O-R-Z-A. That's the fifth in the series.
Oh.
It's got real-world cars and real-world tracks. And every time you race in that game, it records how you race. Are you aggressive? Do you try to pass people?
Oh.
Do you stay on the inside, or you take wide turns? Are you likely to bump another car a little bit and risk penalties to get them out of the way? Will you cut corners a little bit, risk time penalties? How aggressive are you? How do you drive? What are your patterns? And it keeps track of these, discarding older ones as your skill changes. And when someone else plays the game, it'll say, this person is, you know, rank whatever, they average this kind of time on courses. And it'll pick virtual drivers based on real people to race against them.
Oh.
So you aren't racing against real people, but you're racing against computer-controlled drivers that drive like specific real people.
Wow,
they try to take that. And so instead of trying to program just AIs of their own, and they've done some AIs of their own, but they've also created a system where it tries to create them based on how other real people play at that skill level.
See, that's interesting. So does the sophistication of the game designer, has the qualities changed from just, we talked about the puzzles, but to have a little bit more awareness of not just game design, but human nature. So the game designer that really has a feel for human nature, does it make them a better game designer now and in the future?
I think, I mean, again, it very much depends on what kind of game you're making.
Yeah.
But in a lot of cases, like we've talked about, a lot of games are more than just games. They aren't competition anymore. There's the story elements and everything. And so, you know, we haven't yet gotten to the point where you can talk with a computer and it feels like you're talking with a person. It's often called the Turing test, which is a test as to whether a human being can hold a conversation with a computer and not realize it's a computer.
Are we close?
Well, for one thing, we don't really have a good standard for how to decide if something passes it or not.
Oh.
So, you know. So
now you haven't met my next-door neighbor. I feel like
I was going to say, sometimes I say, well, what kind of person, you know?
Yeah, there's all sorts of people. So, yeah, that.
Because there are people who are fooled at times by very advanced software that is designed to mimic conversation.
Yeah.
And then there are people who you know, they don't tend to pass because they're very boring conversationalists.
What if the computer is so good at it, they go, oh, that person's boring, and the computer refuses to talk to the real person? That would be a good movie. Why don't we take a quick break right now? When we come back, I'm going to ask Paul a question. Games of love. I don't know if there's even games out there. We'll ask Paul if there is, and if there isn't, how would that look like? Because that's a big topic in real world, the life as we see it. And, of course, this is People in Games starring Paul Loudon every second Tuesday of the month from 2 to 3. And, of course, right up at 3 o'clock is Understanding Autism. And we will be right back.
Weidenauer, Heinzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Weidenauer, Heinzen & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today. 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com. Weidenauer, Heinzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Weidenauer, Heinzen & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Welcome back again. You are listening to Breakthrough Thinking live here at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. And, of course, the second Tuesday of each month from 2 to 3, it is People and Games starring Paul Loudon. And, Paul, we've been talking about games, defining games, and we've had a lot of different examples. And what I like, what you said, many things, one thing that stuck to mind was the human element makes games games versus a puzzle, where the human element makes it really not solvable.
And that's sort of, you know, where one of the distinctions can very easily lie. Like, you know, is maybe it's not a game unless it's person versus person, and the rules allow enough humanity in it that it's impossible to do it perfectly. That, you know, a game like chess, it really is a puzzle in the long term, even though it's a game right now because we haven't solved it yet.
Right.
That realistically, if you can eliminate the human element from it, then it stops being a game. And while that's a distinction you can make if you want to get really formal about it, it's sort of like, why would we limit ourselves that way? That you know, there's the vast majority of video games are in that sort of gray area where we feel like it's interacting with a human to some degree, or it's interacting with something that isn't just predictable. And you were talking about games of love.
Yeah, I was curious about that because of all the topics I can think of, there's so many variables of human nature when it comes to love. I think that would be an interesting game. Have there ever been any games reflecting that where it's educational or
it's
just not?
Not typically popular in the U.S.
Oh, really?
But hugely popular in Japan. There is,
it is.
A genre of game that might be called a dating simulation, a dating sim.
Wow.
And they often present you with one or more girls. You're typically a male character. They're typically aimed at the male audience.
Yeah.
And you're trying to win one or some of them over. And they're very much more puzzle-like in the sense that there might be some randomness to them of varying degrees, but it's sort of very strategic, very formulaic that, you know, you do certain activities to make the girl like you, you avoid certain activities to make her dislike you. You know, there's numbers that are being tracked whether you know them or not about, like, you know, how stressed she is or whatever, and you're trying to sort of solve the girl. So it's probably not a very healthy representation of dating, honestly. But it's where the genre is at right now, where it's in a lot of cases, not really like interacting with real people, but they are trying in a lot of cases to make them more realistic and more like knowing a person and,
wow,
and interacting with a person. But like I was talking about before the break, the Turing test, the idea that that one day a computer might be able to talk or might be able to have a conversation with a person without them realizing that it's a computer. Until you can really get to that point, and until you can get to the point where a computer can interpret a person's conversation back, which is actually the harder point. Most computers, the reason that they can't hold a real conversation is because they can't tell what they're being told, not they can't figure out how to respond to it. That, you know, if I say I'm feeling fine, a computer has to recognize that that means I'm well, not I'm feeling something, touching something,
right,
that is fine. Or, you know, they have to be able to use the contextual clues. And we're getting really good at that. Back when Watson played Jeopardy, Jeopardy is enormously difficult for a computer because it has to recognize the relevance of the category name. And many of the questions are puns or trick questions. So for a computer to play Jeopardy well, it has to be able to start to use those contextual clues, the category name, the use of certain words in a question to make it humorous, to figure out what the answer is. So this ability to understand natural human language rather than structured questions is what allows a computer to come closer and closer to having a realistic conversation, and that's what will allow dating sims and similar games to become much more interesting and useful as both entertaining games and as ways to teach people about dating. Because when you meet a girl and she's like, oh, man, I'm too tired today to go out with you, and your choices are, oh, that's too bad, you know, or get angry with her, or, you know, walk away, or saying, oh, can I help you with something? Like, when you have choices, that really limits how you think about it and doesn't really create a human and realistic experience. But when she says, oh, I'm too tired to do anything today, and you can type in or say whatever you want to it, and it's able to do something with that, that changes the nature of it dramatically in terms of how you experience it and, you know, how they can abstract, hide the numbers behind it so that you can't as easily work out a system to beat it.
Well, let me ask you this, because computers are a big part of games. Can a computer ever learn to reprogram themselves to go beyond the finite choices they have to an infinite number?
If you designed it properly, yes. There's a concept of,
well,
self-modifying code. And
that's
a
amazing.
Program that
would
adapt itself.
Would that then be like a human being where...
Theoretically, the theory is that if we write the program right so it can modify itself in the right ways, in ways that reflect humanoid,
ooh,
development, and we had computers that were advanced enough, fast enough, big enough memory, something like that could happen. We're not even close to the doorstep of that yet, but it's one of the things
possible.
That's theoretically possible. Yes, a lot of computer scientists believe it's something that we could do if we solved the right problems.
So that's interesting, because there was a movie once, I think it's called Westworld, Yul Brynner, where it was a resort made of robots, basically. Computers,
yeah.
Robots. Yeah, did you see that movie?
No, but I've read about it.
Yeah, and this is sort of an old movie, actually, but Yul Brynner was very well known. And it was like a cowboy western town, and I guess they could make any robots. But so they were programmed in a way that it was somewhat predictable, and usually the people that paid thousands of dollars to go on vacation there you know, wouldn't get hurt because I'm sure insurance purposes and legal.
Oh, yeah.
But something went wrong, and the computers, I think, began to reprogram themselves to do what they wanted. And they start shooting people. I mean, it was crazy. So there's a danger maybe in that, but or are they just acting like a certain population of human beings where certain people's brains go haywire?
Again, it would depend on how they were designed. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, if you design a computer that can learn how to talk like a human and interact with a human, but still has very limited, like maybe even looks like a human being in terms of, you know, two arms, two legs, hands, feet, whatever. But, you know, maybe you only give it certain motion. If one of those motions isn't shoot a gun, then it's never going to shoot someone because it doesn't have that, and that isn't part of its ability to reprogram itself. Because typically, when something is able to alter its own code,
yeah,
there is very, you design it in a way that the adapting or evolving code, as it were, is it's still within bounds because you don't want it just be random. You want it to adapt itself so that maybe some games might be designed to when you play against them, they learn how you play and they try to come up with strategies to counteract your own, whatever. And these aren't really self-programming in the sense that self-programming code would be, but it's the same sort of idea that they react to certain stimulus and adapt based on that. So if you were to have a conversational computer, you might, you know, tell it that it's being rude, and it learns what you consider rude and how to talk with you in a way that you understand. And maybe it talks with other people and learns that not everyone considers the same thing rude. Maybe, you know, that it's all about reacting to certain kind of stimulus and updating its responses based on it.
I don't know if this is part of the topic, but I see amazing possibilities that I'm sure some of the big powerhouse countries are looking at now. If they can do that program, no longer do you have an army of humans. You may have an army of robots. I guess we sort of have that with
honestly,
drones.
Honestly, an army of robots doesn't require anything close to that degree of complication in the most part. That, soldiers... Yeah, you're going to want to trick the robots or whatever, find out the things they can't do, but your bounds are a lot tighter for the most part, I would guess. I mean, I don't know military programming or what their bounds are, but I would guess that it wouldn't be as complicated as trying to make a conversational robot. And honestly, Google and Apple are probably the ones furthest ahead on figuring out conversational stuff.
Oh, really?
Not the game designers, not the army, but those two, or at least they're the ones publicly known to be furthest ahead. Because look at Siri on Google Now. They're both designed to where you don't say, you know, Siri, do a Google search for, you know, you say, Siri, tell me about, or Siri, find me information about. You talk to it like a normal person.
Yeah.
Google Now is designed the same way. You talk to Google Now and you say, hey, Google, what am I doing next Tuesday? You know, or whatever. And it pulls up an agenda for next Tuesday. Or Google, remind me when I get home to check on something. And when you get home, it pops up a reminder saying, so you talk to it like a normal person. And that's sort of what we're talking about, is being able to use those clues to figure out what they really meant from a normal sentence, which humans are fantastic at doing and computers are typically terrible at doing. And so, you know, going back to games, you know, we talk about the line being games as often, you know, humans playing as a human versus being a puzzle, is that this ability to react maybe to language in a story-based game where you interact with characters, or maybe to gameplay. In Forza, for example, you know, in older Forza games, you might learn how the AI works, and that gives you an advantage. But in newer Forza games, you're playing against real people. So that doesn't necessarily give you advantage, because maybe one person, they're really afraid of bumping cars with you. So if you move close to them, they'll move away, and that'll give you an advantage because you can sort of herd them where you want to go, whereas another person is really aggressive. So if you move close to them, they'll just jam in and in front of you and make sure you can't get past them. It adds that degree of unpredictability where even though you're not playing against human beings, it has the unpredictability of human beings. And that's sort of the idea with games in general and whether they're games or puzzles is that, you know, on top of that, you know, it's sort of, would you consider, let's take works of art. We talked about the Stanley Parable being a game where you didn't have a lot of choices, and everything that you chose, there was a preset answer to. But it's still okay to call it a game because it's something we play on the computer. But imagine the Mona Lisa. imagine if when it was originally painted, we'd had some, you know, fancy motion capture there, and we captured every brushstroke he made, and every and recorded the pigments he mixed for the dyes, and got as much information as possible out of this. And then when the Mona Lisa was put up, there was also a program where you could get on your computer and you could pick different pigments so the colors were mixed differently and see how just little changes here and there changed the whole picture. That's not really a game, but at the same time, it's similar to a lot of what we consider games, where it's a toy to play with the world and experience the world in different ways.
Yeah.
And these are the kind of things where it's like, they're not really a game, but they're coming from game design, the ability to replicate things in the world and alter them, because this the idea of simulating stuff and coming up with ways to represent the real world and the virtual world is a lot of what game design is about. So game design leads to these things that aren't games. And so do we call them games because they came from game design, or do we call them interactive experiences? It doesn't really matter, but it's one of those things where you can sort of see this weird evolution of competitive gaming to faking competitive gaming, where you wanted to create a false human to make it so people don't go, oh, this is just a puzzle, I've solved it, I'm done with it, but rather you have the variety and change to keep someone there. And then once you've got a good enough false human, you come up with ways to make the world that false human is in feel real. And then once you've got those techniques, you can use them to simulate things that don't involve the false human. And so it's sort of a cyclical process of improving bits.
You know, it's interesting. You know, with technology and this development and evolution of game design, how you define it, I mean, what do you think it's going to look like, you know, 5 years from now? Is it even imaginable what possibilities could be occurring? Because isn't technology just, I mean, it's just everything's becoming obsolete before it gets going.
Well, 5 years from now, maybe 10 years from now, is going to be a really interesting time, because we've got Sony and Microsoft are both approaching what we call the cloud in interesting ways. Like I talked about the virtual cars, where you could play against virtual people without having to play against real people. Sony, on the other hand, is trying to figure out a way to make their older games playable without having to have them there, that you can play them over the Internet. And so you get them on your TV, but they're running on some computer somewhere else.
Oh.
And there's also actually a couple services that already exist that do things like this. OnLive is one of them. And so with OnLive, I can play Xbox games on my phone, where the game is playing on some Xbox somewhere and the video of what's on the screen shows up on my phone.
Oh.
My button presses go sit back there. And there's a little bit of delay to it because the Internet isn't perfect.
Right.
But as the Internet gets faster and faster, this gets smaller and smaller to the point where most people won't notice it. And those that do will say it's an acceptable amount. And this is sort of one of the places we're going, is that local hardware, local game systems aren't going to be necessary anymore. And then games can get more complex because they aren't restricted by the things people are likely to have. They're instead running on custom stuff that is much more powerful and is shared between a bunch of people. And so that's sort of an interesting path with that. So between that and the ability to sort of record people's actions and use them to influence other people's games, games are sort of crossing the line. Google is working on a game called Ingress that takes place in the real world. You wander from place to place, and you might capture a park or a church or a sign. They're all sort of publicly noticeable places, so it might be a statue at a university campus, or it might be the sign leading into a neighborhood. And if you capture and link three of these in a triangle, you get an area, and your team gets points for how many people live in that area. And so the game allows you play it. People are playing it around you. You are scoring points for someone right now. You have no idea who they are. But you're scoring points for someone right now by living in a certain area. And it's sort of this interesting thing where the game takes place in the real world. And you have meetups of these people. They get together and, like, you know, a group of eight of them will go through an area that the other team holds and capture all the spots in that area on one day. And then, you know, a few weeks later, the other team has taken it back. But they might get together. You might have people, you know, organized and coordinating. They have neutral areas where they meet and, you know, have get-togethers and hang out. And so so you've got this game Ingress, and it's really sort of an example of how games are bleeding over into the real world. And then you've got what's called augmented reality, which Ingress is an example of in a way. But we're getting more advanced augmented reality stuff where, you know, you can hold up your phone and you can see, you know, signs and other, you know, things in the world that aren't actually there. overlaid on top of what the real world looks like. So then you can see parts of the world inside of a game, and so it can go both ways. So, you know, what do you call it when a game is so interactive with the real world? Is, again, you know, it's sort of interesting. We've got Ingress, and then you've got between that and cloud computing and the vast amount of progress we've made on virtual reality in the last year, wearable headsets where you just see the game as if it were the real world and it tracks your head motion and everything. In 5 or 10 years, gaming is going to look fundamentally different to how it does now, and in 20 years, I think gaming isn't really going to be talked about as gaming. You know, we don't talk about movies. Like, we don't talk about, you know, there's not an ing word for movies. You just go to movies. You know, it's just something you do. You watch TV. You know, you play games. There won't be gamers and non-gamers. It's just going to be, you know, what kind of games do you enjoy? Like, you ask someone what TV shows do you enjoy. You don't really ask people, do you watch TV?
It's just part of life.
Yeah, it's just going to be an everyday thing. And it's going to be so integrated that, you know, maybe, you know, where you shop at in general, like rather than having a rewards card for Starbucks and a rewards card for Chick-fil-A and a rewards card for whatever, that you have a game that rewards you for healthy eating or that rewards you for buying products from one company. And so every time you go to Chick-fil-A or you go to Starbucks or whatever, if you get a Pepsi brand drink with your meal, you get points in that game of some sort. And so it's more broad spectrum, and it won't necessarily feel like a reward card, because the way they integrate it, you know, maybe those points don't reward you personally, but help your team. And so you feel like you're contributing to a team effort rather than just getting bonus points. And so, you know, how you present it is going to make a big difference. And I think we're probably going to talk some about this in the future, the idea of marketing through games and gamification. But I think that it's really interesting, the idea that games, one thing about games, and you see it especially with sports, that, you know, that your team, people really rally around their team. And, you know, imagine if there were just right now, today, someone said, okay, let's have a ranking for each football team that shows how much merchandise their fans buy, so you can see which team has sold the most merchandise over the last year. Their merchandise sales would double just by having that competitive element in there.
And
publicly
that's a good,
spoken,
yeah.
That alongside their record for the, you'd see their merchandising scales from last year, and people would be out buying merchandise for their team just so that when their team came up on ESPN or whatever, that number would be bigger than everyone else's.
Just look how these fantasy sports teams are doing. I mean, they're big. I don't know if they're a big business. I think they are, but I joined this year, first time fantasy hockey. But you know, NFL, everything, fantasy sports, I suspect, is like a game. It's just taking your, you know, the draft. You draft your players, and you hope they do well. And there's certain criteria to get points, and that's a whole industry that developed from, I suspect, game design.
I think that a lot of game design elements show up in that. It seems to. I'm not that knowledgeable about fantasy football and fantasy sports, but it does seem to have come a lot from game design.
Yeah, it seems like it, because it's not a reality, but it's based on reality. Because if a real player on your favorite team or your favorite player actually does well, and you have them on your fantasy team, it should give you points based on the criteria.
Yeah, and that's part of the whole, you know, augmented reality thing, where reality and games cross over. And that's what's so interesting about games as they stand now, is that, you know, some people say, well, that's not a game because, you know, like fantasy football, some people might say that's not a game because it's really just based on how well the real world people do.
Right.
You don't really play it. You just watch it and observe it and, you know, reap the benefit. But I think that anything is a game. If you know, if you interact with it and you get some enjoyment out of it, in some way it's a game. I mean, you know, when kids are playing sandcastles, you know, you could call it a game. You know, they're playing some game together, even if there's no rules, even if there's no objective. That it's more about play and the experience, that you're experiencing something. And so, you know, where there's that group that says we should call them interactive experiences, it's more accurate, or games should have strict lines, sure, you know, that's beneficial when we're getting technical about it. But in general, I think that games especially, You know, when you talk about interactive experiences, people are like, oh, what are you talking about? Are you talking about, like, art at a museum or whatever? You know, calling it games, calling all of it games, is really helpful to just getting people to accept it and think about it. You know, it's just something you play with. It's something you have fun with.
No doubt. Can you believe the show has whipped by?
Oh, absolutely.
This is incredible. I think in the future I'd love to talk about gamification related to business. And also a big topic maybe in the future on a future show, how do games impact cultural traditions going forward? Because I would suspect as technology grows as well as games, some of the traditions culturally may change, interactions.
Yeah, I think next month I want to talk about just a retrospective on the year, talking about the major games that really impacted how people talked about games over the year, the games that really, like, you know, said that this game made us think about gaming differently, this game sold huge amounts and made gaming, you know, much more public. Just talk about the impactful games, not necessarily the best games, but the ones that mattered as far as I can tell. After that, yeah, we'll probably go into gamification. And I think you're right. It would be really interesting. There's definitely significant cultural differences in how Japan makes and plays games and how the U.S. makes and plays games. But beyond that, you'll see there's sort of German games. South Korea actually has an interesting gaming culture. That some of it is how they make games, some of it's how they play games. But it'd be really interesting to talk about sort of the regional differences and how games interact with culture. So
that would be great.
That'd
be a great show.
Later on.
And I think we should travel to every country to get a sample of that. Anyway, Paul Allen, thank you so much. This is, of course, People and Games, every second Tuesday from 2 to 3, live. We're here live at the Regis Suites. Stay tuned. Coming right up is Understanding Autism, starring Paul Allen again and Kimberly Isaac. And stay tuned for Understanding Autism.